In the last months of 1943, in the midst of World War II, journalists were already calling for President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's re-election. Unsure of his physical capacity to run for a fourth term, Roosevelt confided to his cousin that he planned to nominate another in place of himself, yet no other Democrat dared announce his candidacy, and the United States needed a formidable leader to see it safely through the war in Europe and the Pacific Rim. In his new book, Final Victory, Stanley Weintraub traces FDR's last presidential campaign. The name of the book is Final Victory, FDR's Extraordinary World War II Presidential Campaign. It is published by DeCapo. Stanley Weintraub, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Glad to be with you.
What brought you to this particular subject?
I've been working on wars for a long time. I was in one. I was a young officer in the Korean War, and I've been writing about various wars ever since. The Revolution, the Civil War, World War I, World War II, the Korean War. So returning to the Second World War was no problem for me. And it's also within my memory. I was a teenager in high school at the time.
For me, in reading this story, it was interesting about what was going through FDR's mind when it came to re-election. Obviously, continuity was wanted, but he had concerns, and most of them were health-related, weren't they?
Roosevelt did not know how sick he was. He had progressive heart disease. He didn't know it. He knew that he was getting more and more frail. By the beginning of 1944, he had lost 19 pounds. And his collars were big, his shirts obviously were too big, and his wife Eleanor and his daughter Anna pushed him to get a medical checkup. And he said, well, I have a medical checkup every day. And he did. The Surgeon General of the Navy, Ross McIntyre, would come to see him daily and would do nothing more than spray his throat for sinus problems and go away. He had not given him a full examination in years. He didn't take his temperature. He didn't take his blood pressure. He just let him alone. And this didn't mean that Roosevelt was getting any better. He was getting worse. And so the book basically opens with Roosevelt going to the Bethesda Naval Hospital because his wife insisted on it to get a checkup. And there the doctors found out, though they didn't tell him, how bad his heart was. A young naval lieutenant commander, Howard Bruin, was there along with Ross McIntyre and other doctors. And Ross McIntyre, as a vice admiral in the Navy, could boss the others around. And he told them, you tell me, don't tell him. And so Roosevelt never really was given the facts about his condition, although he knew that something was wrong when he was prescribed Digitalis, which was the only drug available then for high blood pressure, and when he was told that he had to reduce his smoking and his drinking. He used to smoke 2 packs of cigarettes a day. He was reduced to 5 cigarettes a day. He held every day what he called children's hour at 5 o'clock when he'd have a couple of martinis. He was reduced to 1 drink a day. Obviously, this regimen meant that he was ill, yet the party wanted him to run for a fourth term. The war was far from over. D-Day had not happened yet. The Japanese were still over most of the Pacific, including the Philippines. We had a long way to go, and there was nobody else really who could lead. He had overwhelmed the public from the standpoint of his presidencies. He was nearly finished with his third term. Therefore, he had served nearly 12 years. He wasn't really eager to serve again, but he felt he had to. And he confessed that he enjoyed the job. Both of those things, although they conflicted, meant that he was under pressure that he would accede to run again. He told his cousin, Daisy Suckley, that he had somebody else in mind, for the presidency. Henry Kaiser. Henry Kaiser was unknown to the public except as a shipbuilder. He built the Liberty ships and the Victory ships, almost one a day in his shipyards, that helped us win the war. But he was no party person. He didn't owe anything to anybody, and the party bosses weren't interested in him. They knew that Roosevelt was sick. They didn't know how sick he was, but they felt they had to have a strong vice president. And that became one of the problems at the opening of this book. Who would be vice president? Henry Wallace was the current vice president, but he was a flake. He consulted a Madame Zenda guru for advice. This was, if it became public, this would have been a terrible problem. He was also far too liberal for the conservative so-called Solid South, which then was solid Democratic, although it is just as conservative now and solid Republican. Roosevelt suggested perhaps James Burns, the South Carolinian who was in the White House as an aide and who had been a Supreme Court justice and before that a senator. The party bosses, largely from big cities with urban Catholic votes, couldn't stomach that at all. Burns was a bigot, racist, and also a Catholic turned Protestant to marry. And given the urban Roman Catholic vote in the Northeast and in places like Chicago and St. Louis, this was just unpalatable. They couldn't take Burns, and they pushed him for another candidate. He finally let them have their choice, and that was Harry Truman, the senator from Missouri, who very few people knew, but who had done a good job investigating corruption and malfeasance in the war effort. But Harry Truman didn't want the job. He wanted to stay senator.
I do want to discuss with you about Harry Truman not wanting the job, but I am curious as to what Roosevelt thought of him as a running mate and the discussions that went on between the two. How much did Truman find out about Roosevelt Roosevelt and his illness and a possible succession?
He had heard rumors, but there was no way to prove those rumors about Roosevelt's illness. Truman did not feel that he was up to being president. He didn't have that background, administrative background. He didn't want the job. He loved being senator. Yet he was pushed into this, and the party bosses wanted Truman because he fell between the cracks. That is, he was middle of the road from a state that was between the South and the North. He looked like the right person. They had to arm twist him into taking the job. And finally, Roosevelt talked to him on the telephone and asked him to take the job, and he then had to accede to it. He was a good campaigner, it turned out. But he only met Roosevelt, I think, twice during the entire campaign. This was not an unusual way to do things, but because vice presidents or vice president candidates really didn't have much contact with the presidential candidate in previous campaigns. It was nothing new. But here was a case where the man might become president, and he actually told his friends, "I haven't had nightmares that the president has died and I became president." This was a very strange situation, and although the public didn't know it, Roosevelt realized he had to show feistiness and strength and durability to run again for a fourth term, because pictures of him, one is on the cover of my book, shows how gaunt he had become. He was not the man who was on their campaign posters, which showed him at an earlier stage in his career. What did he do? He became presidential. He went to the West Coast by train. He saw maneuvers at Camp Pendleton, troops who were planning to invade Pacific Islands and Japan. He went on a cruiser after that to Hawaii, visited at Pearl Harbor with Admiral Nimitz and General MacArthur and talked about Pacific strategy. He went on from there to Alaska and was in the Aleutian Islands and Alaska itself visiting troops. This is, remember, a man who actually was dying. He didn't know it, but he went on a 14,000-mile trip around the Pacific to demonstrate to the public that he was okay.
How dicey was this for his opponent, Thomas Dewey? Because obviously you want to show your strength, you want to show your own vision, but you don't want to go against a guy who has been there for three terms, is popular, and is, in many cases, visibly ill.
Dewey had to show youth and vigor and the fact that he had presidential capability. But that presidential capability never really materialized. He made the same speeches over and over again about how the Democrats were spending too much money and the war was nearly over and he'd be basically a peacetime president. They didn't have to worry about the war. That was not true, and the people knew that it wasn't true. This didn't earn him any great credits. He also had problems with the conservative element of his party. John Bricker, the very conservative governor of Ohio, became his vice presidential candidate. And they seemed to be speaking out of two different megaphones, the very conservative Bricker and Dewey, who promised, I'll keep the social safety net that the New Deal has brought us. So they were on opposite terms. And there had been fights in Congress about permitting soldiers to vote. In fact, it's practically a parallel to what we have now in the sense of the absentee ballot was a problem. Would we allow soldiers to vote by absentee ballot? Would we restrict the vote in other ways in a possibly racist fashion? The southern states did not want blacks to vote. There was still a poll tax. A lot of problems came up, and the New Deal safety net had not yet been completed. The GI Bill was struggling through Congress as Roosevelt was thinking about running for a fourth term. The GI Bill turned out to be perhaps the greatest legislation for social mobility in the history of the country. It passed by only one vote in Congress when Roosevelt arm-twisted a congressman from Georgia to come and vote. And yet the GI Bill was actually written by a former chairman of the Republican National Committee. It was a Republican draft, but they fought it, which again sounds like a parallel to today when we have a Massachusetts medical insurance law that is being fought not only by the former governor who established it, but by his party. It seems there are parallels in every presidential election. But Roosevelt had to show that he was still a powerful president who could serve further and ignite the populace to vote for him. When he came back from Alaska, there was a report by one of the congressmen from conservative congressman from Minnesota, Harold Knutson, that Roosevelt had left behind his Scotty dog on one of the Aleutian Islands, and warships had to go back and get him at great expense to the war effort and to the budget. It was not true. And Roosevelt used that in his first major speech when he came back from Alaska, speaking in Washington. He said, I don't mind when you attack me, when you attack my wife, my children. All four of his sons were serving overseas in the military. But my Scotty dog fella resents it very much. And he went on in that fashion. The public loved it. And the reporters said after that speech, Roosevelt is back.
Yeah.
And he had to stay back. He had to continue in that fashion.
In our
he went to New York City traveled 54 miles in an open convertible in the rain around New York City, spoke at Ebbets Field and then the Dodgers' home. He went to Philadelphia and did the same thing. He went to Chicago, spoke at Soldier Field to 100,000 people in the open with a cold wind at 14 degrees blowing off Lake Michigan. There were another 100,000 or more outside listening on loudspeakers. And finally, before the election, he went to Boston and spoke there. Orson Welles introduced him. Frank Sinatra sang America the Beautiful. The Bobby Soxers loved it. And the public thought that he was the old campaigner, the person they had known for 12 years at that point. But the campaign had really exhausted him. He was reelected, by a very big electoral vote majority, something like 432 electoral votes to 99. But he only served 83 days of the new term before he died in April 1945. To me, the prediction of his election that is most fascinating is something I discovered in the Dewey papers that are in the University of Rochester Library. His campaigners cut out a letter to the editor from a Syracuse newspaper in which the writer says that one of my friends has predicted that Roosevelt will win again by a smaller majority than before, but he'll win again, and that about 6 months after the new presidency begins, some biggie unpredicted event is going to occur that will end the war. And he said, my friend John Dalrymple told me this. Of course, he added, John Dalrymple died in 1910 at age 26. He, in other words, got the psychic information. To me, that's the most fascinating thing I found in all of my research. And it's in the Dewey scrapbooks, not the Democratic papers.
In our final moments, and we just have a minute or two left, but and you alluded to this about the comparisons of the election that we're going through now and the election that happened in 1944, and just in the inside flap of the jacket of the book, it says 1944, a president under siege, a war-wrecked economy, an influx of returning veterans, a challenge to Social Security. Some things never change, and indeed some things never change. But we look at this election and we say, okay, but what can we take from that 1944 experience as we enter into the final 3 months or so of this?
What can we take from it?
Yes.
I think you've already explained some of that by what you've just read. What we can take from it is that the ends are always going to protect what they have stood for and what their record has been, and the outs are always going to defame that record and claim that it wasn't what it should be. And we have to read between the lines in both cases.
The name of the book is Final Victory, FDR's Extraordinary World War II Presidential Campaign. The book is published by DaCapo. Stanley Weintraub, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Best of luck with the book. Thank you.
Again,
the name of the book is Final Victory, FDR's Extraordinary World War II Presidential Campaign, written by Stanley Weintraub, a National Book Award finalist, professor emeritus of arts and humanities at Penn State University, and the author of more than 50 highly acclaimed books, including Silent Night and Pearl Harbor Christmas. The new book, Final Victory, published by DaCapo. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.